We're talking to Terrell Matheny, who is program director of 1080 WKLO in Louisville. Of course, most people growing up in Louisville in the 60s knew him better as his on-air persona, Mitch Michael. Terrell, how are you doing?
I'm well. I was the Mighty Mitch pitching hits with RBIs. That's records batted in, Daddy. That's records batted in.
Oh, man, you still have it, huh? You still got it. Well, tell me, when exactly were you at WKLO?
I started out as program director and afternoon drive disc jockey, and then after a while, I became the vice president of programming and went off the air for about the last year that I was there.
Okay, what years are we talking about?
I joined them on my birthday, August of 1964, and I left in early February 1968.
Okay, where were you before you came to WKLO?
Immediately before WKLO, I was afternoon drive disc jockey at WOKY Milwaukee, and I had worked in Nashville at WKDA before that.
Who were the owners of WKLO?
WKLO was owned by, it was then called Air Trails, later it was called Great Trails. And I worked with them both in Milwaukee, and then later on as Great Trails, I was general manager of their station in Milwaukee, and I worked for them in Louisville as program director. Air Trails also owned WRIT in Milwaukee, and in 1964, I had a 57 share, an afternoon drive at WOKY.
Wow.
I never was sure that I had that George Michaels, the fellow has the George Michaels sports machine, did afternoon drive on WRIT, and Johnny Madman Michaels did afternoon drive on WEMP, and I did afternoon drive on WOKY, and I figured I probably got credit for all three guys with the same name.
Well, you'll take them no matter how they come, right?
I was happy.
Yeah, you were happy getting those numbers. Now, tell us about coming to Louisville and working for WKLO. What was the state of radio at the time at WKLO, and also Wacky? What was Wacky like at the time?
Well, WKLO was not in really good shape when I got there. Ernie Gudridge was the general manager. He had been with Air Trails for several years in other markets, and he had been sent down to Louisville to fix WKLO. And he was looking for a PD, and the general manager of WRIT in Milwaukee told Bernie about me, and we got together, and I came down. It was my first PD job, and Ernie was pretty brave to gamble on me. When I got there, WKLO was a hodgepodge. There really wasn't much of a format, if any. I think the guys pretty much did whatever they wanted to do. They didn't have a particular direction. They played pretty much what they wanted to play. Of course, that was pretty much the case with a lot of radio stations in 1964. I changed just about everything, and I did it almost immediately. First, I put the jock under a very tight music playlist. I called it a sound hour. Later, they were called clocks that restricted every time a guy was going to play a song. He had a choice of maybe three or four or five songs to play. I don't remember how many titles we played, maybe 40 or 50. In those days, we had an extremely, what today you would call a tight list. Wacky was the top station, and they had been since McClendon put them on the air in 58 or 59, whatever it was. And they had two things going for them. They had a great name, they had a great signal, and they also had two things going against them. Their top high-profile disc jockey, Jack Sanders, had made headlines shortly before I arrived by getting involved with, an underage girl. Big scandal. And the other thing is their program director, for some unknown reason, banned the Beatles. And they weren't playing Beatles in mid-1964. And the Beatles were the hottest things in the world. So the first thing I did was put our guys under a tight format. Wacky had great call letters, easy to say, easy to remember. WKLO were terrible call letters, didn't stand for anything, didn't mean anything. So I renamed it Radio WKLO, hoping that by saying radio first, it would set up WKLO, and at least people would remember WKLO or KLO. I put in something called a stab. It was a Sonovox jingle that played at the end of every record, and right over that stab, the disc jockey came on and said, Radio WKLO time. So we had call letters on top of call letters, and we were double whammying them with call letters, hoping to brainwash them. We played a Beatles record every hour, and we had a very tight, disciplined Sunday school clean sound. We won the hearts of the parents. In some way, we got to the kids, and they came along pretty fast.
Do you remember Wacky reacting to what you did at KLO? Did they change their programming any?
I don't think they did. I think they figured they were so strong that we were going to be like a little flea on a dog's back or something. I don't recall that they reacted to us at all. They just sort of sat back and let us have it. We had a highly disciplined radio station, which was unusual in those days. And I don't think they understood what we were doing to them by coming on with the formatics, the tight playlist. Their disc jockeys, their programming people would listen to us and say, my God, what are they doing? They're screwing up their station with all those formatics and those liners and all that kind of stuff. In reality, we were just getting it all together.
How long was it before you started to see results with WKLO and the changes that you made?
In those days, we had the Hooper rating, and we got a Hooper every month. And in the summer of 64, I think WKLO was ranked third or fourth. Wacky would have been number one, and then Wave, and maybe Win, and perhaps WHAS in there, and then WKLO. In January of 65, WKLO became number one for the first time by one-tenth of a point. We actually started the 1st of September, September, October, November, December, and then we were number one by one-tenth of a point in January, and then from then on, we just soared.
All right, let's talk about some of the people that were on your air staff when you got there in 1964. Did you clean house or just kind of try to work with the guys that were already there and give them a chance?
It was my intention to work with all of them. I ended up cleaning house simply by accepting resignation. I don't remember who all was there at the time. I don't recall that I fired anybody. Jim Fletcher was there, and he stayed and was there when I left. Alan Bryan was doing evenings. He stayed and was there when I left. We made him news director. Bill Crisp was doing mornings. He left when we brought Bill Bailey in. I wanted him to stay, but he wanted to do mornings, and I wanted him to do middays. I remember there's a fellow named Darrell Smith who had worked at WABC in New York, and that was a little bit intimidating at that time, but at the same time, Farrell was living on his past, and he really would not do what I wanted him to do, and we confronted each other pretty quickly, and he opted to leave. I don't remember who the first jock was I hired. Probably Chuck Browning, who was working at WINN in Louisville. He was the most gifted disc jockey I've ever worked with. I ride a motorcycle. I tell people anyone can ride a motorcycle 50 miles an hour, but it's very difficult to ride it 5 miles an hour. Anyone can open a microphone and talk for an hour, but it's very difficult to say a lot in a few words. Chuck Browning could make more emotion in 10 seconds than most people could create in 10 minutes. He was absolutely brilliant. He had the soul of Ray Charles, the voice of Barry White, and the attitude of a real wise ass personified. And I loved him. He was one of two disc jockeys I took to New York with me later.
All right, you mentioned Bill Bailey. Did you hire Bill Bailey?
Yeah, I did. He was not the first. He probably came on about a year and a half after I came on. He was working in Winston-Salem, North Carolina, and I don't recall now how I heard of him, whether he contacted me or somebody told me about him or what, but I listened to his tape, and he was doing old-fashioned yak-it-up radio. But I heard that voice, and I heard that pseudo-accent of his, and I just fell in love, and I talked to him, and we would talk for hours at a time and trying to determine whether or not he would do or could do what I wanted him to do. And that was simply to continue to tell these stories that he told. But I wanted him not to do it 5 or 10 minutes at a time, but to do it 30 seconds at a time. And finally, after a lot of conversation, we agreed that he would start one of his rambling yarns, and then he would talk for about 30 to 40 seconds. And no matter where he was or what he was doing, he would just hit a button and play the next commercial or whatever was coming up. When it was over, he'd come back and pick up the story as if nothing had happened. At first, it was a little rugged, but finally he got the hang of it. And before I hired him, I took the tape into Ernie Goodrich, who was our general manager and quite a guy. And he took the tape home in the radio station. He didn't hear the magic, I don't think. He took the tape home. He listened to it while he was having breakfast. He said he listened to it while he was brushing his teeth and shaving, and while he was shaving, it hit him. And he came back and said, yeah, let's do it. So we hired Bailey, loaned him bus money to get to Louisville, paid him $165 a week. He and his bride and baby arrived in town. They stayed with me for a while until he got a little flea bag of an apartment someplace. And he started off. First week he worked there, he came in and quit five times. And during that period of time, I think just about every disc jockey there came in and threatened to quit. Johnny Randolph, Bill Crisp, all the fellows were calling him Mitch's Folly. After a while, things sort of worked out. He caught on, he calmed down, he relaxed, they began to accept him. I laughed because Bailey had a drinking problem, and there was a bar next door to the station called Kev's, and about a year after Bailey started, they used to slip him out the back of the bar in the afternoon while I was on the air to keep me from seeing him stagger because they knew I'd get on his case. These same guys who were threatening to quit the first week were then protecting him. He was the magic that made WKLO. He was the magic that made Wacky years later. He was the guy who made it all happen.
Was Bailey difficult to work with?
Well, no and yes. I mean, he was really easy to get along with. He's a nice man. He was a cuddly guy, and he had demons. He drank too much. He would go into a bar in the evening, and he would say, "Bartender, set him up from all my friends." And he would not have enough money to pay the bar tab. I'd get a call and bail him out of jail. Or his wife would call me at 4:30, 5 o'clock in the morning and say, "Bailey has a toothache, or he's sick, or he has that, and he can't work." Finally, we began, Ernie Gudridge, the general manager, was a brilliant man, still is. We got together and decided to just control Bailey. So I remember I called him into the office one day, and I started complimenting him, and I kept pulling him in closer and closer. "Bail, you are the best disc jockey in town." "No, no, 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 no. You are the best morning disc jockey in Kentucky." "No, no, no, forget that. You are the best morning disc jockey in the United States." "No, Bailey, actually, you're the best disc jockey in the whole world." And by this time, he was right up close to me. And then I slammed my hand down on my desk and I said, "But you're not worth a damn when you're not here. And if you are ever late again, I'm going to fire you and run you out of town. On the other hand, Bill, if you will be good and be here on time and not make me go up and come and do your show in the morning, if you'll do it from now until whatever the date was, like 3 months later, we happen to have tickets at such and such hotel in Cincinnati. We have tickets to the Coney Island such and such concert. And you're going to go over there and have this wonderful weekend with you and the Duchess and the Dukelet all on the company." Well, he was as good as gold for those 90 days. We sent him off to the weekend. And from then on, about every 90 days to 5 months, we would send him someplace if he had been good and he stayed good. Then we took over his finances. He got paid, and the paycheck was immediately endorsed over to the bookkeeper who paid his rent, his car payment, his everything, and then we gave him some spending money. And that way we kept him under control, and he was a model citizen.
Now, were you there when he left for WLS?
No. I left probably maybe a little more than a year before that.
Did that surprise you?
It didn't surprise me that he left because he had offers all the time. And he was so good that he could work any place. I only regretted that I didn't hire him to WMCA in New York. He was good enough to work any place he wanted to work. And when WLS came along, it was a great station, great opportunity, good money for him in those days. It didn't surprise me. He had a number of opportunities while I was there to leave and go someplace else. He was a great, great radio personality, and he worked it out at WKLO so that he could do his thing and at the same time follow the format. He was always bigger than life. He was always troubled, but some way or another, he got through it. And today, you sit and talk to him, and it's like talking to him 30 years ago, except he doesn't look the same. When Bailey left WLS, that was an interesting thing because he was hired by Rook to WLS. Rook and I talked about that, and I told him that Bailey was a handful, but if he was willing to really work with him, and he was worth it. And Rook didn't understand what a handful I was trying to describe to him, and he hired him, and he was not prepared to put up with Bailey. And they got crossways, and then Bailey left. And when he quit WLS, he said, "As soon as I'm number one in Chicago, I'm going quit." And Rook called him into the office and said, "Bailey, the ratings just came in. Congratulations, you're number one." He says, "Good, I quit." And he came up to Milwaukee and stayed with me for a couple of days. And at that point, I don't think he had a job. There's all kinds of stuff about Wacky being responsible for him going to WLS and all that. I don't know whether that's true or not. But when he left there, he did not have a job. And I suspect he probably would have enjoyed coming back to WKLO, except that they would not have paid him the kind of money that he had been making in Chicago. And I think WAKY tried to pay at least more. Every time Bailey was offered a job while I was program director, and there were numerous times, he would come in and say, I was just offered a job at so-and-so place, and they're going to pay me $200 a week, or $250, or whatever it was. I would sit down with him at Ernie's directions and say, Bailey, if you go, God bless. You have been a wonderful, wonderful asset to this radio station, and we will miss you. There is nothing that we can do to compete with that other station with money. You know what you've got here. You have security. You have friends. You have this. You have that. But we will not and cannot get into a bidding war. And then he would make his decision to stay. We would congratulate him, hug him, and a week later give him a raise. And then I don't know what might have happened after I left, but I think that bringing him back, they would not compete with Wacky on a bidding war.